Frank Costigan and Transparency International were always a good fit. Since its launch in 1995, TI has been the only international non-government organisation with a concentration on corruption. With a membership of large and medium-sized organisations and corporations, as well as individual members, it's played a key role in raising awareness around the issue here and overseas. Transparency International unambiguously sees corruption as undermining good government, distorting public policy development and implementation. It sees corruption as having the capacity to hurt the disadvantaged. When Frank became a board member in 2003, his childhood experience growing up in the aftermath of the Great Depression and throughout World War II, his working career, his strong beliefs and values made him a natural to embrace Transparency International. I'm a contemporary of his, as you've heard. I too grew up in that era, went to school with children who didn't have boots, didn't have a breakfast, and saw the hardship of those days and the rationing of the war. So it's a generation that wasn't indulged with material things. Now that's an important part of his background to accept, but consider also a childhood and an education in a strong Catholic household. A commitment and belief in the aims of the Jesuit Social Services that began when he was a student at St Patrick's College, East Melbourne. A wide and very varied practice in the law, and I suppose a knowledge and experience gained from arguably the most controversial Royal Commission in Australian history. To preside over a forensic inquiry backed by the resources of governments and to take him to places that did give him a first-class knowledge of corruption, both here and in other parts of the world. I unhesitatingly say that his adoption of the values of the Australian Labor Party at a time when sectarianism in Australia was arguably at its highest required someone with guts. Any Catholic member of the Labor Party, I think there's a few here tonight, will recall at that time anyone who contested, any Catholic who contested the political direction, both the direction it took and the direction it gave, of the Catholic Church in Victoria after the mid-1950s, was a person of courage. But from the early 1960s, Frank had gone a step further. He was active in the ALP, and that's when I first met him closely, although I had known him before, and we enjoyed a common interest in that political party in Victoria. It was an interesting place in those years. Along with others, we were trying to restore some moderation and some sense into the party after the split of 1955. It was during those years, I think, that I came best to understand and admire the calm and analytical and measured approach that he brought to issues. So what I'm saying to you is that by 2005, when Frank became chairman of the Transparency International Board in Australia, he was no stranger and no shrinking violet so far as controversial issues were concerned. It's not surprising that in the TI News of May 2008, writing as chairman, he saw the big picture and drew attention to the links between, I quote, corruption in the local council area and in the public service and political areas. He went on to say, and I quote again, the corruptors are often found in the private sector. One does not need to look at recent disclosures at the Wollongong Council to understand that the most serious form of corruption is an abuse of entrusted power, and such abuse is to be found at all levels of public and private activity. End of quote. Predictably, the published obituaries following his death made copious reference to his work heading up the Ships, Painters and Dockers Royal Commission. Doug Maher, who's I'm pleased to see is here tonight, the Queen's Counsel assisted him at that Royal Commission, said in an obituary published in the Melbourne Age, 14 April 2009, an aptly headed, I think, a lawyer, a soldier of conscience and crime fighter. And I quote, The commission was a success. It revealed and explained the pernicious effect of organised crime and recommended the National Crime Authority, now the Commonwealth Crime Commission. It recommended laws for recovering profits of crime and reporting of international financial transactions and better enforcement of laws suppressing tax fraud. There were a large number of successful prosecutions and many millions of dollars recovered by the Taxation Office, as well as confiscation of criminal profits. More recently, I spoke to Doug Maher, and he told me that he and Frank were both of the view that, and I quote, corruption in the public and private sectors goes hand in hand. James Morton, in an obituary in The Guardian, 27 May 2009, wrote, and I quote, his inquiry uncovered widespread links between union and organised crime, including wholesale theft, robberies, horse race fixing, drug dealing, both nationwide and in Asia, and prostitution run from the office of the Crown Solicitor in Perth. Close quote. So here was a man who could have been a Supreme Court judge, but he chose otherwise. He had all the experience, conscience and concern about all the issues that Transparency International seeks to expose and combat. So what I said at the outset is this made for a very good partnership. And now it's extended by Transparency International, linking this oration to its former chairman following his death. And I thank you and welcome the opportunity to be part of it. Now, my approach tonight is a fairly simple one. We're all affected by world events. And as Victorians, what happens here, as well as across the nation, and our federal system, which divides the nation's powers of governance, has to be taken into account as well. At the outset, I say to you, I adopt the Transparency International definition of corruption as follows. And I quote their definition, corruption is operationally defined as the abuse of entrusted power for private gain. Pretty simple. The abuse of entrusted power for private gain. Now, I'll try and examine how that corruption plays out at each level that I've mentioned. I'll examine it in the private and the public sectors and how each relates to the other and the way society, business, governance and politics is evolving. Some of the issues canvassed will suggest that the potential for corruption is increasing and there may be growing tolerance for it and acquiescence in it from some quarters. The new kid on the block is the carbon emissions issue, which is creating demand for cost guarantees to be underwritten by government. I'll look briefly at the agencies we have in place as well, and to the agencies that are there to inquire, regulate, and protect society from corruption. I should qualify what I'm saying, that for reasons of time, I don't canvass what basically drives corruption in the abstract. Suffice to say that changes in the established allocation of resources appear to be a common cause, with both winners and losers alike responding to threats and opportunities that such changes create. Now, can I begin by having a bit of a look at recent economic history? Frank became ill at a time now described as the sharpest economic downturn since the Great Depression. I don't think you'll find too many to quarrel with that. And I suspect that had he and many others of his kind would have said we should have seen it coming long ago. And he would have been right if he'd said that, I think. Some did see it coming, but chose to do nothing about it. And I say that interest in and concern about behaviour in government and business seems to come and go in surges. That as far back as June 24, 2002, following the Enron debacle, Fortune magazine published this, I quote, when it comes to reporting earnings, US companies have about as much credibility these days as judges of Olympic skating, close quote. I'm not sure whether David Crawford had that in mind when he offered his report yesterday. The same piece went on, and I quote further, phony earnings, inflated revenues, conflicted Wall Street analysts, directors asleep at the switch. This isn't just a few bad apples we're talking about. This, my friends, is a systemic breakdown. Nearly every known check on corporate behaviour, moral, regulatory, you name it, fell by the wayside. replaced by the stupendous greed that marked the end of the bubble. And that has created a crisis of investor confidence, the likes of which hasn't been seen since, well, since the Great Depression. That's the fortune quote which I end. Now, I bring you to the 2008 Transparency International newsletter that refers to the Cole inquiry into the AWB and to the, in so doing, to the HIH Royal Commission report. It says, in what I think is a very telling quote from former Justice Cole, this, and I quote, "The conduct of AWB and its officers was due to a failure of corporate culture. The question posed within AWB was, what must be done to maintain sales to Iraq? The answer given was, do whatever is necessary to retain the trade. Pay the money required by Iraq. It'll cost AWB nothing because the extra costs will be added into the wheat price and recovered from the UN escrow account. But hide the making of those payments, for they are in breach of sanctions. No one asked what is the right thing to do. Instead, much time and money was spent trying to determine if arrangements could be formulated in such a way as to avoid breaching the law or sanctions, whether the conduct could be protected by various subterfuges from discovery or scrutiny, and whether actions were illegal or illegal. The question, what is the right thing to do, sounded familiar to me. A very similar question was posed in the HIH Royal Commission report, where Justice Neville Owen said, and I quote from Owen now in the Cole dictum, "From time to time as I listened to the evidence about specific transactions or decisions, I found myself asking rhetorically, did anyone stand back and ask themselves a simple question, is this right? This was by no means the first time I've been prone to similar musings, but I think the question gives rise to serious thoughts." End of quote. Now, the Enron and the HIH prosecutions, which are referred to there, did lead to criminal prosecutions. AWB, it seems, is currently the subject of what's characterised as a civil action by the Australian Securities and Investment Commission, alleging former boss Andrew Lindbergh breached his duties to AWB because he knew about the secret payments to Iraq and failed to halt them. Rarely, I think, has Australian corporate conduct, either before or since the Cole dictum, been very concerned about by that question, is it right? Is it right? Rarely. Each decade or so, the behaviour seems to get worse as economic gloom and downturn envelops us. In better times, poor conduct may seem to matter less, but most times the moral compass is far away from the decision makers in the business world, and they rarely ask themselves, is this right? When the big one, that's what the downturn has been referred to, hit the world and out of the US in September 2008, that's just 14 months ago, remember, it was generally agreed that the long boom was over. One graphic narrative of this was the published account of the demise of the merchant bankers Bear Stearns in the US. Now, remember, Bear Stearns went down early. It went down in March 2008. So, and the book was published just about March this year. But Bear Stearns went down before Lehman Brothers. And it's entitled, that book on Bear Stearns is entitled House of Cards, How Wall Street's Gamblers Break Capitalism. It's a subtitle, it's by William D. Cohan. And here the author says toward the end of his book, published, as I say, in mid-2009, not very far back, and I quote, "The players seem to be saying after the proclaimed breakpoint, the demise of Lehman Brothers, that is, that these things do occur with some regularity, and we haven't ever figured out how to stop the next one from happening." End of quote. Now, this seems a bit puzzling to me, because this is an age where we seem to micromanage, we rate, we mitigate, and we control risk. There's a large swag of professionals in this town and across the country who've made a business out of being risk managers. In all sorts of odd things. They've made an industry of it, and I just wonder at it. But why don't we do it around the risk of the next one? It's an extraordinary allocation of or lack of allocation of priorities. And what I'm saying to you tonight is that this is the attitude and culture that still dominates industry and in the US, in Europe and Australia. Nothing seems to have changed. I'll be saying a bit more about that to you later. When Cohan, the author of that book, turns to why it happened, he adopts the dictum of a number of others, and he says, in effect, it's a team effort. He says government, ratings agencies, Wall Street, commercial banks, regulators, investors, everybody. They're all in it, he said. That's his conclusion. It's a great book, I recommend it. It's 600 or 700 pages, and it's a telling insight into the corporate world of the US. Bear Stearns only formed in 1926, but it's a long while in corporate terms. Fell over in spectacular fashion. I remember a year or two back, an estate agent I'd known for a long while, he said to me that the Bliss Boom was different to all the others. And he believed it. He had lived through the boom of the 80s, but he still believed it. I suppose that's understandable because he's in good company. You see, if the Sydney Diocese of the Anglican Church can be induced to borrow money to buy shares, why not the mums and dads of Townsville or elsewhere who saw Storm Financial and the CBA as a reliable allies in their quests for wealth? Would the CBA appear quite so uncaring about the clarity of the commercial arrangement which we read about with the mums and dads if it were still in public ownership? I don't know. But like Cole J said at AWB, did that corporate culture come into play as CBA sought to maintain the loan book, just as AWB sought to maintain the sales of wheat to Iraq? Now, I shouldn't just single out the CBA because there's many, many instances of the same sorts of things that are happening. I'll make one further comment on this issue, though. The CBA and Storm Financial and Macquarie Bank, according to the latest news reports, are squabbling about who should have told the borrowers about who were at the bottom of the food chain, I might add, who should have told them that their margin call was due, which might have mitigated their loss. Did any of them ask the question, if they had, what's the right thing to do? They'd all have told the borrowers, wouldn't they? All of them. But none of them did. I don't know whether this is, and you may make a judgment, whether this is a significant issue of morality in the marketplace, or just an example of one party being better informed and vigilant. And maybe it's caveat emptor, I don't know. Now, can I take you back just a few years to examine the environment that prevailed and nurtured this, what I call indifference to finding or examining long-term memories. I want to just summarise what I see as being the features of the post-World War II economy. It's going back a long while, but it's worth doing, I think. Booms and busts have increased total material wealth over the long term, but with growing disparities in wealth and income between them within nations still continuing, I think growing worse, the disparity. Regulatory interventions to control excesses have had some success, but many, many failures. I see, according to the radio coming in tonight, that ASIC had another failure against Jody Rich. But anyway, the failures are monumental. During the last 20 years or so, a clear move to the market economy model with governments and business growing more interdependent. Now, don't underestimate the significance of that on this whole issue. The experience of WA Inc. Shouldn't be forgotten. It's a fair while back now, but it shouldn't be forgotten. It should warn us that such closeness and interdependence may not always be a good thing. In the months following the acknowledgement of the global economic crisis, governments around the world, to their credit in my view, have incurred massive public debt to maintain financial stability. And things look to be on the turn, we are told. And I bring you more closely to the last 8 or 9 months or so, because that's been a period where it's been widely touted that the Australian economy has gone a long way towards recovery, that we're leading the world, if not pretty close to it. So there's good signs for us. I want to suggest four matters that make me put an ingredient of some pessimism over that. Because there are some who are saying, in my view rather loosely, that it's really back to business as usual. One journalist characterised as saying, some in the business community seem to believe that the music never stopped. Now, the four issues I raise as giving me some cause for concern are these. Financial bosses still behave badly. And this is demonstrated in many ways, but I highlight one, that's the executive salary issue, where I think that large egos and greed cling to notions of comparative wage justice quite wrongly. They inferentially justify, and they're doing it day after day, board meeting after board meeting, they justify their salaries in this way. They say, well, you get the best and you pay overseas and you ought to pay these salaries. They see nothing wrong with Australian corporations paying their bosses between 100 and 200 times average weekly earnings. They're unabashed about it. They just don't get it, in my view. This is all about egos and greed, and that demonstrates to me a worrying shallowness in those people. The second issue, the ratings agencies that tick the CDOs that are claimed to have caused the GFC, all those bits of paper that are flying around and being sliced and diced that we read about over the months last year, they seem to be alive and well, and with little evidence that their ways have changed. The ASIC announcement a few days back of stricter regulation of rating agencies to come into effect in early 2010, well, the best I can say about that, it's a bit late. You see, what I would say is the world has known for more than 18 months, perhaps 2 years, how bad these outfits were, Fitch and Standard & Poor's and these people who were being paid by one person and recommending the paper that they were being paid to look at and rate. So I say that the world has known for a long while how bad they were, and I've put them in the same category as the big four auditors who have been able to create an illusion of infallibility around so many things like risk management, with barely a whimper of concern in the lead up to the crisis. It should be remembered that the big four was once the big five, wasn't it? What happened to the fifth one? Thanks to Enron, it fell over. So they're not infallible by any means. So all this is happening despite the chant that we hear requiring regulators to do more and to be more alert. The third thing that concerns me and leads to some pessimism is that the financial engineers, and that's the generic type they seem to win over the last 2 or 3 years, they seem to be finding more new products, as they call them, to take into the emerging markets. In a report in the Melbourne Age of the 21st of October, chairman of the ASIC, Tony D'Aloisio, flagged bans on some financial products being sold to retail investors as they are too risky. Now, this is a welcome move, but you've got to make it work. The fourth issue that concerns me is about the massive sums of new capital, which make the music never stopped and it's all back to normal, seem real, that have been raised, estimated by Terry McCran of the Sun Herald, at $100 billion in recent months, as these large corporations, they've promoted new share issues at considerable discounts to prevailing market prices, devaluing consequently and of the existing shareholders. In a piece of Sunday, in the Sunday Herald of Sun, dated 28 September 2009, under the heading Mums and Dads Missing Out, Terry McCran claimed that most of the shares issued with this money raised have gone to large institutions and not through, quote, issues equally to all shareholders. Now, Terry's been on this for a fair while. He's the only one who has, I think. He's one of the few commentators who's been prepared to pursue this over recent months. Why the others don't get it, I don't know. They're frightened they'll be cut off from the information chain by the big end of town. There has to be some reason why they don't. So why did governments, I'm looking back over the post-war picture that I tried to paint, the period since World War II, I think governments went along with these trends and these initiatives because people were happy, and they should have been happy. Their material wealth increased greatly and they wanted that. That's understandable, and that's entirely understandable. As I said earlier, the downside of that to me is that while all this was going on, the disparity in both wealth and incomes widened. And that's both in nations and between nations. Now I want to have a quick look at I'm going reasonably well for time, I think, at corruption in the public sector. As a penal colony, it always seemed to me we were very quick to embrace corruption around grog. That marvellous book of Dr. Evatt's of the Rum Rebellion, we were terrific. Got into it very quickly. But we were just as quick, I think, as colonial settler states. And this is true, I think, of most settler states that the European powers colonised in that time. We were all pretty good at it. But we were very good. And I think that was despite a quite rapid transition to both representative and responsible government in this country. But corruption around land settlement, land development, liquor, drugs, law enforcement and gambling. It's all through our history. It's interesting to read. It makes for racy stuff, but it's all there. So we've got a fairly significant track record. And later on, I suppose mostly post-Federation, or certainly around Federation time in the early 1900s, the era of industry protection and tariffs introduced other versions of the corruption pattern. The recent free market, and I refer to the last 20 years in particular, creates more acute corruption issues around the instance, I think, of taxation, subsidies and grants, and the allocation of government work, for reasons I'll say a little later. And I now want to say to you that in this market economy, at least six things have emerged or changed to make governments more susceptible to outside pressures. These are all changes, to the point I made before, to the established resource allocations. And there's winners and losers. So just think about these. Governments have sold off public infrastructure and contracted out delivery of services. It seems to be the fashion, not just here, but elsewhere as well. Competition for government contracts has grown fiercely. These and those of you, and I'm one, member of a legal profession, you get yourself on the government legal services list to get government work as well. There's no exceptions. Lobbyists, they're in the news. You've got to link lobbyists, I think, with political donations, and they've become a key influence in policy direction. The importance of lobbyists, I want to emphasise, and is often overlooked, I think, isn't just around their access or capacity for access to ministers. It's more subtle than that. It's their knowledge of where to tap into the bureaucratic and the private office food chains where the early briefing notes emerge. That's the key to it. You then have a capacity to shape the early thinking in the long line of checks and balances that people in this room, many of you know, occurs both in government and in the private sector. So they know where those originate and who to ring up to exert influence at an early stage. I have asserted before, and I say it again, that all this has been compounded by political parties doing very little policy work and analysis. It's a disease across political parties. I don't know why. In my early years in politics, political parties did serious policy analysis work. They took it seriously and they produced good policy work. The Victorian government has seen, I think, properly so, the emerging role of lobbyists as warranting a new and stricter code of conduct. It's published, I imagine many of you will have seen it, material that seems sound, and it's an initiative that deserves support in my view. We're going to have a Victorian government professional lobbyist code of conduct, and it's been issued, and there'll be a register of lobbyists. to be created. There's already one in Canberra. And it's been there. The last time I made inquiries, I think there was 900 on it. So it's a big business. The fourth emerging feature that I like to draw your attention to is that retired politicians and ministers have, in large numbers, become paid corporate consultants. That's the term of art that's used, I think, mostly. But it's across both sides of politics and at all levels. The fifth issue is that the world money markets, the ratings agencies to which I referred earlier, still exert huge pressure on governments and central banks. The first reaction that government and treasurers look for when they bring in their budget, what have the ratings agencies got to say about it? That's the way they fly money around the world. That's inevitable, I suppose. And the sixth issue is that the public-private partnerships that seem to be very fashionable now are growing as a means of providing public infrastructure, with some, the most neutral term I can use, I suppose, some ambivalence about where risk lies. The County Court in Melbourne is, I think, arguably the most mature of these processes, and a good friend of mine who's had a good look at it says the jury's still out. It's a bit early in after 10 years to say. So they take time to properly evaluate how it's all gone. Now, the point I'm making is that all of those things that I've mentioned have drawn governments closer to the public, to the private corporate sector. And if you look at the last edition of Transparency International material, they report in 2009, this year, that the perception, this is the term that's used, around business and those close to business, is that, and I quote, that government officials, national, state and local, are corruptible, that bribes may be paid for any number of purposes, to win contracts, to avoid regulations, to speed up services, and to affect government decisions examining planning proposals, and that a regulatory regime where it exists is often slack and under-resourced. This can be exploited. Now, that's Transparency's view of what we face, and I've tried to give you mine of where we're vulnerable. Now, add to that, I think two other things are changing. It's predicted that economic activity will grow rapidly as we emerge from the downturn. I think that's probably right. It will. And it's claimed we're leading the way. And this will bring more frequent and closer contacts, for the reasons I've outlined, between the public and private sectors. And the drive to win government preferment will be strong, and quote the abuse of entrusted power close quote to which Frank Costigan referred, and to which the definition of TI refers, may well be found at all levels of public and private activity. Now, that's a summary of what I believe is happening. It's an expanding world economy, a growing domestic economy, and more and closer relations between government and the private sector right now. And all of this time, I think the world is growing in its acceptance of the need to do something about carbon emissions and the carbon-constrained economy, which some believe is leading to the largest reallocation of economic resources since the Industrial Revolution. That may be stretching it a bit, but it is a very profound reallocation that we are facing. The coal industry and the other big polluters have been strident for some time now, almost since this debate began, in their claims for concessions. Some of these are not reluctant, by this I mean the coal industry people, to assert influence over government simply because government has listened to them, as government should, and government must. There's a piece in the paper the other day that they were saying more than that. What they are saying, some of them, in this industry, is that being close to government means that government is influenced by us, and that's very mischievous. It's mischievous at the best and worst. At its worst, it's malicious. That they would so interpret that kind of relationship that government, in consulting with stakeholders, as they're called now, should talk to them. There's a piece in the Melbourne Age of just a week or two back, 7 November, headed Browning Down Australia. It asserted stridently in an opening box, I quote, "With a swathe of lobbying firms behind it, business has not been shy in pressing its views on who should bear the cost of cutting emissions in Australia. And this business of persuasion is the same the world over. That's the end of the box. This piece goes on to confirm the concessions already given to the big polluters, and that business is in a frenzy to get the ear of government at all levels. And I want to say to you that the pressure on governments will be potent. Recently, power generator TRU Energy was reported to be demanding, that's my word, but I don't think it's misstating the position, considerable compensation before it would agree to build a new gas-fired power station. The implication being that otherwise it would stay with dirty coal-fired electricity generators. That was what they said. Now, this is a very tough line to take, and I think it's bordering on the arrogant. I don't know why they do that. I think it's probably a belief that they can impress their rivals as to their power with government and their capacity to take a strong stand. Okay, now in the context of all that, it's time I had a look at what we've done and should acknowledge what we've done to regulate, control and apprehend corruption. The results have been mixed, and that's true of both the preventative and the regulatory or remedial actions. We now have around us a very wide array of regulatory bodies with comprehensive powers of investigation, of arrest, search, seizure, coercive powers of questioning, electronic surveillance, and with some limited judicial oversight. These can intrude with ferocity into both the public and private sectors. On the face of it, it may seem that the multiplicity of agencies should be a positive for Australia, but the reality is that the record of cooperation and working together is not a good one. I'm saying that we need them, but they don't seem to get their act together sometimes. Now, all of these powers are justified on the grounds of protecting the public. We're told that despite the erosion of basic rights and freedoms, the innocent have nothing to fear. That's always. Every time that transfer or give away another raft of civil rights, that's always the plea. The innocent have nothing to fear. I suppose fighting terrorism has, to some extent, set the pace in the erosion of rights, and fighting crime has gone along for the ride. But that's the double. Okay, so what are the corruption fighters? Who are they across Australia and Victoria? Federal and State Police, Customs, Australian Tax Office, Australian Crime Commission, Australian Securities and Investment Commission, Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, various state-based crime commissions, the Ombudsman, Office of Police Integrity. Now, that's a quick shopping list that I put together. I think it's probably fairly comprehensive. And this list has grown and evolved in response to events and disclosures in recent years. And they, whilst I say they have a role to play and we need them, I'm also saying that we have to watch closely. They don't overstep the mark. I think as a complement to this as well is the vigour of our parliamentary system, despite what some may say about it. Questions with or without notice and annual reporting, the grievance debates and House committees, and add to this the independent reporting to Parliament by the Auditor General and Freedom of Information. I think it all adds up to a fairly rigorous bundle of scrutiny. Over recent times in Victoria, we've also had inquiries around police and abortion, liquor licensing, land deals by government agencies, failures of financial institutions, and they've all added, I think, to the resources and information available against a raid against corruption. If you examine the claims around some of the turf wars between agencies, it's difficult to find many gaps. They seems to me double up in many places. But this hasn't diminished the call, it still is there, for a state crime commission in the two mainland states that don't have one, Victoria and South Australia. And today, commentators and academics and politicians seem to favour a crime commission in Victoria. This was not the case 5 or 6 years ago when you read the editorial and newspaper cuttings. Many of these writers have changed, and I'm not sure why. I've tried to find out. As I said, agencies on the job are numerous and powerful, and I just want to say I wouldn't want to give anyone else, any of them, more of those powers than we have already surrendered. If the agencies we currently have can't do the job, then I'm not sure what can, because there's been some criticism here of the Victorian government's claim that the Ombudsman has lots of these powers that you would give to a Victorian Crime Commission, and that no ombudsman, the opponents say no ombudsman should have those powers. Well, you might, if you leave them with the ombudsman, they could be subject to scrutiny or examination by a parliamentary committee, as the Auditor General is, if you wanted to qualify it. I think we, in summary, governments can claim that the regulatory agencies haven't performed across the board in terms of results as well as they should. I referred to delay in action before, and even allowing for the problems of our federal system, I think we've had delivered to us less than was the case, less than we should have expected. I don't think we need more agencies. I think we perhaps need more competent ones in some regards. I point to Tony Fitzgerald, who's an authority about Queensland, I think. He recently questioned how effective the Queensland Crime Commission has been up there. It grew from his report, of course, in 1989. He says that Queensland is a little better now than it was in the 1990s. The jailing of two former ministers of that state a few months back hardly inspires confidence about that state's commission. And looking more generally at regulators we rely upon, governments and the public, I think, should be more critical than we have been about the performance. Agency oversight should have done better on the little we know about Storm Financial, about ABC Learning, about Centro Properties and Bris Connections. And there's a dark side to all this, I think. It's the seeming inability of our agencies and regulators to examine promptly and keep pace with those market players. Now, I know it's tough out there, but I still think we have cause for disappointment. There are many in the US, of course, who assert vehemently the deterrent value of the criminal law process to fight white-collar crime. I think it's a fair summary to say that Australian governments and their regulators seem by recent conduct to be rejecting this. Maybe after today's decision they'll reject it even more. Almost 20 years ago, I saw at fairly close hand how poorly regulators and auditors performed their statutory duties around financial institutions here in Victoria and around building societies in particular. And I think more of the same over the last few years has been emerging. Okay, it's time I finished, and I end this with some conclusions. Transparency has set out some very bold predictions about levels of corruption, and after 16 years, I think it's a voice of some authority. The new and emerging factors that I mentioned, I think, make the case for more serious and increasingly widespread corruption as being a prospect here and other parts of the world. I summarise my reasons for that view as follows. The economic recovery started, it's variable, and some places it's very fragile. All sectors of the business and commercial world are desperate to win more favours from governments so that they do prosper, and they've already enabled many of them to survive this last year. No opportunity for favour or preferment will be lost by those players. The politics of recovery and restoration for the immediate future will modify or even extinguish, I think, the case for deep reform of this system. As I said before, avoiding the next one will not be a priority. Will not be a priority. All the evidence makes that clear. Now, overarching all of this is the and now emerging demands from business for handouts to compensate for carbon emission reduction programs, as community costs are now being quantified and people are starting to see what the cost of the carbon issue might be. These trends will bring government and business closer, whether we like it or not, and with or without the facilitation role of lobbyists and political donations. It's just going to happen anyway. The last thing I want to say is there is no reason to think any broadly held desire to adopt the culture of what's the right thing to do with Col J enunciated. There's no evidence at all of that. And that's a culture that he found lacking at AWB and which I think Frank Costigan would have urged. Thank you.